This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, December 29, 2004, at KPFA in Berkeley. I'm Deepa Fernandez. Tsunami death toll rises dramatically. We hear about how aid is not being distributed to the Tamil Tiger-controlled areas of Sri Lanka. In Gaza, the Israeli army has been attacking the western Khan Yunus refugee camp with tanks, missiles, shells and bulldozers for the 12th straight day. And we look at the rise of vicious hate crimes in the US. Plus other stories right after these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies now estimates that when the devastation in Asia is counted, as many as 100,000 people may have lost their lives, up to a third are children. A spokesperson for the organization Save the Children estimates that more than 1 million children will have lost one or both of their parents. Bodies are being buried as quickly as possible, but according to witness accounts, the smell of decomposing corpses thickens the air in affected areas, as does the grief of those who have lost a loved one. As many as 65 aftershocks rocked Indonesia, scientists say it is unlikely that an aftershock would generate another tsunami. More on the tsunami's aftermath coming up. The official Ohio recount has found 300 more votes for John Kerry, but activists say that is just the tip of the problem and vow to keep fighting. Evan Davis reports from Columbus.
Ohio Secretary of State Ken Blackwell announced that the change in the reported vote tally as a result of the recount reduced the 118,000-plus lead held by George Bush over John Kerry by just 300 votes. Numerous discrepancies remain, however, and attorneys who are currently contesting the election in a lawsuit filed with the Ohio Supreme Court have uncovered what they say are widespread violations of Ohio's election law, both by individual county boards of election and by Kenneth Blackwell himself. Several remaining discrepancies, which were not the focus of the recount, the lawyers contend, may yet demonstrate that more than the number of votes now separating Bush and Kerry may have been fraudulently assigned to the wrong candidate. John Kerry himself has belatedly joined an existing lawsuit filed by the Green Party's David Cobb to protect critical evidence such as ballot and voting machines. But Kerry attorney Dan Hoffheimer, in an email this week, dismissed those who are alleging fraud as conspiracy theorists. Hoffheimer's email asserts that the Bush victory is final and that the Kerry campaign will only be concerned with correcting problems that may affect future elections in Ohio. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Evan Davis in Columbus, Ohio.
Argentina's former president Carlos Menem returned after 9 months as a fugitive from justice and says he will make another run for the presidency. Matt Goldin reports from Buenos Aires.
Carlos Menem ushered Argentina into neoliberalism during his 10-year presidency. He was accused in April 2004 of involvement in embezzling $10 million during the construction of two prisons and of failing to declare funds in Swiss bank accounts. He moved to Chile early this year to escape Argentine judges. He decided to fly back home only after the court told him that he will not go to prison, as the probes against him continue. Now Menem says he wants to stand in the next presidential election in 2007. It is not clear whether Mr. Menem plans to be permanently in Argentina or return to Chile. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, this is Matt Goldin from Buenos Aires, Argentina.
The Environmental Protection Agency announced this week it would enforce a deadline to ban the controversial pesticide Dursban by December. Erica McDonald has more.
Monday's letter to Dow AgroSciences ended weeks of speculation that the EPA might allow the company to continue producing the termite pesticide for 3 more years. Under the agreement reached with the EPA in 2000, Dow must stop producing Dursban for home building at the end of this week, but it may ship existing stocks of the pesticide through December 2005. The ban only restricts production of Dursban applied by home builders before laying a foundation. Dow may continue to produce Dursban for other uses, which include spraying crops, golf courses, and as a mosquito repellent. Dow officials say federal and academic studies linking Dursban to developmental disorders in young children are flawed. EPA will allow Dow another chance to prove Dursban is safe when it reevaluates the ban next year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Erica McDonald.
Human rights activist, novelist, essayist, and intellectual Susan Sontag died yesterday after a long struggle with cancer. Ginger Otis files this report from WBAI in New York.
Author, activist, humanitarian, and social critic Susan Sontag died Tuesday at a New York cancer hospital at the age of 71. In 1975, Sontag participated in the Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness series, produced at WBAI. Sontag joined Allen Ginsberg, Murray Bookchin, and T. Grace Atkinson in a discussion of the American Revolution and its legacy. Sontag spoke about how she reconciled being an artist and community activist.
That doesn't mean that you can't get out and be in demonstrations or in address meetings or lick envelopes or do all kinds of other, quote, activist things. We are essentially solitary people, all looking and in and out of various kinds of communities, because there is a contradiction between what is still individualistic in our work and the communitarian longings that all of us in different ways and perhaps from somewhat different points of view have been involved with.
In recent times, Sontag was an outspoken critic of President Bush and in particular the U.S. war in Iraq. In May this year, she wrote an essay in the New York Times arguing that the shocking photographs of prisoner abuse at Abu Ghraib would likely become the defining images of the war. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ginger Otis in New York.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
A UN official today said the death toll from Sunday's tsunami in Indonesia alone could be around 80,000. The devastation in Indonesia is higher than in other countries because it was hit by both the earthquake and the tidal wave. In Banda Aceh, Sumatra, and many of the hard-hit areas across Southeast Asia, mass burials have begun. Meanwhile, aid agencies have grave fears of more deaths due to spreading disease across all the affected countries, especially in remote areas where aid has still not reached. I spoke today with an Australian volunteer, Gemma Connolly, who's just west of Sri Lanka's capital, Colombo, who says that politics has already begun playing a role in the aid distribution process.
There's a road that leads from Colombo all the way down to the south of the country, and it basically runs about maybe 100 metres from the coast the whole way down. And so when the tidal wave came in, basically just covered that road and has done quite a lot of damage. There are buses and cars overturned, still blocking the road. So a lot of the aid will have to go inland, which will take a lot longer, and cuts across things like rice fields, where it's just one lane of a dirt road and through a rice field. So a journey, I heard yesterday, a journey that normally takes 3 hours, took 8 hours yesterday. So that's slowing down the process of the provision of aid there.
And one of the things that hasn't really been talked much about is that Sri Lanka is actually a country which is in a lot of political turmoil, and there are areas that have been hard hit which are controlled by the Tamil Tigers, the LTTE. Can you talk about what's been happening there?
Really, the government has been trying to rally people around, and, you know, Sri Lanka is one country, and at a time like this, political differences shouldn't make a difference. But reports have been coming out of the north that no aid has basically reached there at all, that they're complaining that the government aid is all going down to the south as opposed to going into the areas that are controlled by the LTTE. We've also heard of reports of convoys of food that's been taken over to the east that have actually been hijacked by the LTTE at times, just because they're so desperate, but also that doesn't help the situation. It just creates further sort of animosity between the two groups.
Now, besides the aid that's needed in terms of food and water and maybe basic housing supplies, there are also great concerns about disease breaking out. How's the government going to respond to that?
I'm not really sure that they have a precise sort of action plan for that. A lot of doctors have been flown in from overseas, and almost every doctor available in Sri Lanka is working, is heading over there to the affected areas. They're requesting donations of medical supplies now. It's moved on from the sort of dry rations and drinking water. And they're trying to limit the amount of people that are going into those areas so as not to spread disease. But there's a lot of paranoia here, about, you know, what's going on, and certainly a lot of rumours going around about infected fish and don't eat this and don't eat that. And so I think the sort of rumour mill is causing a lot of fear, extra fear in the survivors of the situation.
Do you sense that there might be or has there yet been a sort of rush on Colombo, the capital, of people from the affected areas?
I haven't heard of a rush into Colombo apart from the rush of foreign tourists that have all descended upon there in any way they can. There's been more of a rush into the village areas that are further inland from the ocean. There's a real sense of grief that's coming over the country. My boss's neighbour, for example, lost 17 members of his family. And my boss is a Muslim, and in the Muslim community, they've lost entire communities on the East Coast, 200, 300 people. And so in that community, only in Sri Lanka, there's just a sense of grief for the loss, the huge loss of life. But it's something that they also struggle to comprehend. And obviously we're not going to know the full details for probably another week or even 2 weeks.
Gemma Connolly is an Australian volunteer based just west of Sri Lanka's capital, Colombo. Meanwhile, as the death toll in South Asia rises, now somewhere between 85,000 and 100,000 people are presumed to be dead, President Bush made his first public comment today, 3 days after the tsunami struck the region on Sunday. Bush outlined an aid package totaling $35 million, but declined to say if the U.S. would provide debt relief to the nations hardest hit by the humanitarian and environmental crisis. Ingrid Drake has more from Washington, D.C.
Yeah, they can make the contribution there.
Yeah, right. We can start because saying that.
For the last 3 days, Priya Ranjan's Maryland basement has been the Association for India's Development base for emergency fundraising efforts. While Ranjan and a handful of other volunteers have gone without sleep, answering phone calls and website pledges, the group has raised over $500,000 to support the short and long-term needs of those hit by the tsunami in South Asia and Africa. Mohan Duggett with the association has been inspired by the efforts of volunteer groups, mostly young people, on the ground in India and Sri Lanka, also working around the clock. Yet Duggett was saddened that U.S. President Bush did not react at once to the disaster.
President Bush is a rich man. He has no feel for what happens to the poor. I can understand why he thinks it doesn't matter, that there are lots of other people speaking. I wish he had spoken. I happen to be a citizen of the United States. For me, it is important that the leader of my country not only is compassionate, claims to be compassionate, but is actually compassionate.
This morning, President Bush did take a break from his vacation to make a public statement expressing his condolences and support for the people devastated by the tsunami. Bush also responded to a recent comment by Jan Egeland, United Nations Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, that wealthy nations need to do more to support global emergency relief efforts.
Well, I felt like the person who made that statement was very misguided and ill-informed. Take, for example, in the year 2004, our government provided a $2.4 billion in food and cash and humanitarian relief to cover the disasters for last year. That's $2.4 billion. Now, we're a very generous, kind-hearted nation.
The United Nations says the tsunami relief is one of the biggest global relief operations in history and has already seen more than $220 million pledged and received. Yet, the United States' role in this international effort has been called into question as Bush plans to spend between $30 and $40 million for his upcoming inauguration celebration, the same amount the U.S. is pledging for tsunami relief efforts. Juan Cole, a professor of history at the University of Michigan, says actions speak louder than words.
The amount of resources the U.S. has so far pledged are tiny compared to the need. Much more needs to be done. The United States is willing to spend $1 billion a week on its war in Iraq, but seems unwilling to pledge $1 billion a year to respond to a crisis like this.
By some estimates, the U.S. spends what it promised on tsunami relief in less than 4 hours in Iraq. Bush's delay in offering support may set back relations with countries with large Muslim populations, already strained by the U.S. war on terror, says Professor Cole.
Well, of course, one of the hardest hit countries was Indonesia, which is the largest Muslim country in the world with regard to population. Moreover, the particular area of Indonesia that is most hard hit by the tsunami is Aceh, which has been roiled by a separatist movement of Muslim activists who want to be independent from Jakarta. And so this is an area where Al-Qaeda has tried to get a foothold. And so it just seemed to me that a U.S. Pledge of help to the people of Aceh and of Indonesia more generally would have been wise in regard to the politics of the war on terror.
While President Bush has pledged to form a coalition with other nations to devise the best approach to relief and reconstruction, Mohan Dagat from the Association for India's Development is planning long-term fundraising efforts to support the needs of the families devastated by the disaster.
I want to deeply, deeply thank the community here. How warm the response is to let us know that, yes, we care. No matter how far we are, we care.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ingrid Drake with the DC Radio Co-op.
In the Gaza Strip, the Israeli army has kept the Rafah border crossing closed for the 17th day in a row, with all main roads in the Gaza Strip also still closed, barring residents from moving. Movement of ambulances and medical teams has been severely restricted. This comes as an Israeli soldier stationed at the Gani Tal settlement bulldozed family farmlands east of Khan Yunis after invading the area. And as FSRN's Mohammed Omar reports from Gaza, the Israeli army has been attacking the western Khan Yunis refugee camp with tanks, missiles, shells and bulldozers in an assault that has continued on and off since December 17th.
The Israeli incursion has so far resulted in 17 dead, almost 71 wounded, at least 300 people left homeless after dozens of houses were destroyed. The incursion continued throughout the last week and spread in northern Gaza Strip, where missiles were fired at heavily populated areas. Last Wednesday, three Palestinians were killed in Khan Yunis camp when the Israeli army shot in a crowd. And on Thursday, two were killed by missiles also in Khan Yunis. Al-Haji witnessed the event.
All we saw was a shell coming from the air, making the sound pop. Stones were falling to the ground. The children were sitting upstairs where they were living. Oh God, they were living there upstairs. As soon as I heard that loud bomb, I screamed. Then I saw the metal opening, the stones and human flesh shreds just spread everywhere.
Over the past week, at least 80 Palestinian homes have been completely destroyed, mostly in Khan Yunis refugee camp. Ali Abu Zerga is a 12 years old child who lives in Khan Yunis with his brothers and sisters.
My name is Ali Abu Zerga. While I was sleeping, the Israelis invaded the camp and announced by loudspeakers, "Evacuate your homes." We were sleepy and we took the school as shelter. At that time, there was a strong wind and very chilly weather. When we went back to our houses after the army withdrew, we found our homes were completely demolished.
Ali's family has taken refuge, along with dozens of other families, at the United Nations-sponsored school in Khan Yunis refugee camp. Over the weekend, two more Palestinians were killed by Israeli tank shells in southern Gaza near Al-Buraj refugee camp. And 6 years old, the child dead of one inflicted aerial. The latest death has brought the overall toll since the September 2000 start of Al-Aqsa Intifada to well over 3,500 Palestinians. 20% of them are children. 970 Israelis have also died in the same period. The people of Khan Yunis have asked for international support to stop the Israeli incursions, but have received no response from the United Nations or anyone in the international community. For Free Speech Radio News, Mohammed Omar, Gaza Strip.
Six white men are facing federal arson charges in Maryland after burning new homes where African Americans were moving in. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, racially motivated crimes caused by young people is on the rise. Dolores Bernal files this report.
Washington, D.C. suburbs have been growing rapidly in recent years. In southern Maryland, signs advertising new homes are not uncommon along Indian Head Parkway. There are over 30 developers building communities there, with new homes each costing $500,000 or more. On December 6th, 10 homes were burned down and 16 others were damaged in the upscale community of Hunters Brook in Charles County. Some homes had been purchased by African American families, while others had already moved in. Investigators had first believed that radical environmentalists had set the homes on fire, but the investigation led to the 6 white men. 2 are now under house arrest, and 4 are being held in prison without bail. The men were not associated with any recognized white supremacy groups. The properties were built in a predominantly white working-class town, which led investigators to question whether the crime was racially motivated.
You know, you often do get hate crimes, particularly in suburbs that are changing in demographic terms.
Mark Potok is the director of the Intelligence Project at the Southern Poverty Law Center in Montgomery, Alabama.
If you have, for instance, a county with that has been very largely white, and particularly lower middle class or working class white, and you start to have a whole new population move in, whether that be blacks from the city or perhaps Hispanic immigrants, you very often do get these kinds of conflicts.
The 6 men belong to a car racing gang called the Unseen Cavaliers. The gang raced cars on the rural roads of Prince George's and Charles counties. Other similar race-motivated crimes have taken place across the state line.
We was on our way to another church that Sunday morning, and my neighbor that lives down this road from here, her son come up to get some water for some neighbors, and he seen that somebody wrote racial stuff on the church doors.
Sharon Henry helps to run the First Baptist Church in the town of Good, Virginia. In August, the church was vandalized by 2 white teenagers.
He had on the side of the wall on the picnic table, and he went around to the back of the church. They had broke the windows out and wrote inside the church, found out about God and stuff, about black people and everything. Then when we left the church, we come down here to see for ourselves, and then the police had been down here investigating, and the church was just a mess.
The church is over 150 years old, with a black congregation of 65. The 2 boys had spray-painted racial slurs and tried to set the church on fire, but only managed to burn down the cloth on the altar. The boys caused $7,000 in damages and were finally convicted as juveniles and sentenced to 5 years probation and community service. Again, Mark Potok of the Southern Poverty Law Center.
We are seeing not only violence among young people on the rise for racial reasons, but also the formation of youth hate groups, both groups that are helped along by adult hate groups and groups that are created by kids completely on their own. So it's really quite a phenomenon we're noticing. It's hard to say definitively, without question, youths are committing more hate crimes now than they were several years ago, but as an anecdotal matter, it certainly does appear that way.
Mr. Potok says he believes that racial tensions and nationalism within the ethnic and racial groups in the United States is on the rise. Groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center are increasing public education and hate crimes prevention campaigns. Meanwhile, this Hunters Brook resident, who asked not to be identified by her real name, summed up her feelings about crimes.
I hope they spend a long time in jail to think about what they've done. They hurt people and damage their property.
Reporting from Washington, D.C., I'm Dolores Bernal for Free Speech Radio News.
Colombia's largest Marxist rebel group, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the FARC, has asked UN Secretary General Kofi Annan for the opportunity to address the UN General Assembly in September to explain their side of Colombia's 40-year armed conflict. In the communique, the FARC reiterated their conditions for a humanitarian prisoner exchange with the Colombian government, demanding the demilitarization of a swath of land and the liberation of 500 jailed FARC insurgents in exchange for the liberation of 63 hostages they're holding. On December 17th, President Uribe rejected the FARC's proposal to demilitarize an area of southern Colombia and to swap hostages for its jailed members. Instead, Uribe has given the FARC until December 30th to release the 63 hostages, including politicians, soldiers, and 3 U.S. defense contractors. Otherwise, Uribe will extradite the FARC's most senior captured rebel leader, Ricardo Palmera, to the United States for charges of kidnapping and cocaine trafficking. Meanwhile, the Colombian armed forces continue their largest offensive against the FARC in the rebel stronghold of southern Colombia. From the state of Caqueta, Nicole Carson takes us down the Quagan River through the heart of the military offensive known as the Patriot Plan.
At a checkpoint along the Quagan River, FARC commander Eider Mosquera, who commands the FARC's 14th Front in the Southern Bloc, told a group of journalists that the Patriot Plan has not weakened the FARC. The U.S.-supported Patriot Plan, a component of the $3.5 billion Plan Colombia, began last February deploying some 18,000 Colombian troops to combat the FARC and rule out the region's heavy cocaine production. Colombian officials have called the Patriot Plan a success, despite severe casualties suffered by the Colombian troops. But Mosquera says, here, they are still intact, alive, and kicking. Along the Gawan River, the Colombian armed forces have set up checkpoints, moved in Navy ships, and are trying to win a region controlled by the FARC for more than 40 years. The song says, the money of Plan Colombia has been used to bring only weapons, planes, and death. Civilians who had lived under the FARC's rule now must negotiate between the guerrilla and the Colombian armed forces. Resident Elena Mosqui wishes the Colombian state would have brought more than military might.
The army came in mass last February. But why don't they send doctors? Why don't they bring medicines? Things that we need here since we're totally isolated from the world. Being in land so rich, why are we so abandoned? Why are we so alone?
According to the local human rights ombudsman, the Patriot Plan has caused the forced displacement of some 5,000 residents. Villagers have given testimonies of torture and rape committed by the Colombian armed forces. One village, called Peñas Coloradas, is now a ghost town, only inhabited by the anti-narcotic police, army, and navy, who base their local operations here, and who, according to dozens of testimonies, forced out the local population to install their military base. René Sanchez was one of the 2,000 people forced to flee Peñas Coloradas.
Y de otras maneras empezaron a torturar a la gente, a golpearlos y a meterle guerra psicológica.
The army began torturing people, hitting them and psychologically threatening them. They asked people about the guerrillas, and whoever didn't answer was yelled at and hit. They tied up an elderly man and tortured him. They said they were going to finish him off. This was the threat. They threatened to kill us.
Critics, like Father Jacinto Franzoy, who has been the local priest for the past 26 years, says that because Plan Colombia and the Patriot Plan have been mostly military efforts, the policies have done little to bridge the gap of social ills that spawned the guerrilla and the drug trade.
Cambian los slogans, cambian los presidentes. El abandono del campo es...
Plan Patriot is just a question of names, of slogans. For 26 years, the policy for the Colombian people hasn't changed. The presidents change and the slogans change, but the abandonment of the people in the countryside is tragic and dramatic. Peasant land reform was a basis for Colombia's conflict or revolution, and it's now been 40 years and a civil war was never declared.
The FARC's recent communique appealed for support of the United Nations, the Vatican, and countries like Venezuela, Spain, and France to assist in setting up a humanitarian prisoner exchange. However, tomorrow marks Uribe's deadline for the FARC to hand over 63 hostages or face the U.S. extradition of their commander, Ricardo Palmera. From Caquetá, I'm Nicole Carson for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, and KPFK in Los Angeles, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. For an archive of today's newscast or previous FSRN stories, go to www.fsrn.org. In New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez.